So it's not just you. The measurable quality of everything from housing to food to cars has taken a significant dive. More consumers than ever are stretched incredibly thin between rising debt, rising prices, and stagnant incomes. When you can't get any more out of them, the only option left is to give them less for the same. Out of greed or desperation, companies are turning basic features into premium extras and alienating a lot of consumers in the process. But what else is new? Well, what else is new is that now it's backfiring on these businesses in a big way, and what we might be seeing firsthand is that going all in on anti-consumerist practices is, shockingly, a great way to chase away consumers.
Ohio for Responsible Gambling is warning many popular holiday gifts for children, especially video games featuring these things called loot boxes.
Like poker machines, loot boxes use sound and visual effects to create a buzz of excitement and anticipation.
Some question whether they're going up a little too fast and claim attention to small details is lacking, creating problems for the buyers.
But some of those new homeowners are seeing massive issues.
Stars starting to show up in the showrooms. New auto prices are rising.
The cost of owning a car is just as bad. According to Cox Automotive Moody's Analytics, the average cost of a new car, $47,000.
Over the last two decades, very few major markets have seen changes quite as widespread and expensive as the car industry. A push towards electrification, new major competitors from China and South Korea, self-driving technology, tighter regulations, and hundreds of billions of dollars in investor money has made it extremely difficult for companies to adapt to every single last change while also delivering a product that's not shit. Dozens of companies are betting their entire future on the next 5 years. But that's happening as a lot of people are still underwater on their last car, so they're not in a rush to buy their next. Technology is changing so quickly that cutting-edge cars today might be completely redundant in a few years' time, meaning the right thing to do for most drivers is to sit back and wait. The investors, on the other hand, are realizing that if you invest billions of dollars to disrupt a market, you shouldn't be surprised when the market gets disrupted.
Congratulations.
Tesla CEO Elon Musk unveiling the taxi of the not-so-distant future, the Cybercab, at an exclusive event tonight.
It's now moving towards electric vehicles, so Jaguar came up with a bright plan, a complete rebrand except for cars. This time, they're selling vibes.
Everyone knows the minute you drive a new car off the lot, its value depreciates. But for electric vehicles, the drop is dramatic.
They're calling a million hybrid vehicles because they may catch fire. The Prius plug-in hybrid, and the CHR SUV model are all needing electrical system repairs.
A few months ago, the British car company Jaguar announced that it would cease producing cars until it could totally rethink its entire product lineup. The prestigious automaker was once a British alternative to German luxury brands like Mercedes, Audi, and BMW, even though the company was technically Indian. In recent years, though, the company has released cars that were plagued with reliability issues, lapses in quality, and were generally much worse value for money than even the premium brands they were trying to compete with. The company's I-Pace compact SUV was supposed to be their mass-market product of the future, but it had worse range and tech than most other small electric SUVs, all at a significantly higher price point. The only thing really selling the cars was their premium brand image, but that can only last so long. Last year in an interview, the company's own chief creative officer admitted that the company had no brand equity left whatsoever. The only thing keeping the company alive was its shared ownership with Land Rover, but eventually it was just taking up space on dealership lots that could be filled with cars that actually sell. In response to sales numbers that were circling the drain, the company has stopped selling cars with the plan to entirely relaunch the brand. The first phase of this plan was launched last week with a brand new logo and marketing video that drew mixed reviews. Advertising a new and improved car company without actually showing any cars is a bold strategy. Now, a British car company making horribly unreliable cars and then going bankrupt is not worth making a video about. That's just what they do. But this is just a sign of a much wider issue that is affecting the whole industry, and that is simply, nobody knows what the f*** is going on. Back in the good old days of 2021, Ford and Volvo were amongst the first traditional car companies that made a pledge to transition their entire fleet to electric vehicles in certain global markets. At the time, demand for EVs was outpacing crippled supply chains and credits made them quite affordable. Last month, the companies had quietly walked back their ambitions because the market for electric vehicles changed in three big ways. The first was that electric vehicles specifically have been the target of major sanctions across the world, primarily targeting cheap cars coming out of China. Despite all of its Swedish branding, Volvo is actually owned by Geely, a Chinese conglomerate holding company, and a lot of its EVs are made in China because the battery supply chain is far more mature there. This means that their fully electric fleet would be uncompetitive in markets like the USA, unless they move production there exclusively, which would be hard for a lot of their vehicles. The second reason is that at the same time tariffs are going up, subsidies for EVs are coming down. The price premium of an electric car in many places was offset largely by tax credits that would cover a significant share of the purchase price. These have become less popular as people are seeing them as their tax dollars going to subsidize some tech bros Model 3. And the third, simplest reason is that people just don't want to buy EVs. Early adopters are a relatively small market, especially for such a valuable purchase. Even those customers who are happy to put up with a little bit of inconvenience or a higher price point to do their part for the environment or just to signal how forward-thinking they are not going back to EVs. A survey conducted earlier this year by the McKinsey Center for Future Mobility found that 46% of current EV owners would shift back to an internal combustion engine car for their next purchase, citing issues with charging infrastructure as their primary concern. Now, people rolling coal in their lifted F-350s are probably never going to switch to an electric vehicle unless there is literally no other option, apart from something completely unthinkable, like public transport. But even the group that was already won over and made the big purchase are switching back, making car companies across the industry reconsider going all in on EV. Even Tesla, the undisputed king of EV sales in America, is starting to hit a plateau in new deliveries. The first quarter of this year marked the first time since the launch of the Model S that they delivered less cars in the same quarter the year before. Other new EV companies like Rivian and Lucid Motors, which were hopeful competitors with Tesla, are still losing tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of dollars on every car they sell because they have had to offer extremely competitive cars to market to tempt buyers to take a chance on a relatively unknown company. The cars they are making are some of the best engineered machines on the road. But they are now only being kept alive by multi-billion dollar financing rounds from foreign governments or incumbent automakers who are probably more interested in their technology than their actual cars. To keep up, every other car maker has to also compete with a company that is losing money on every car they sell, which is putting even very well-established automakers in a tight spot. To tempt new buyers, car companies have to spend billions to keep on offering something new that makes their old models seem irrelevant by comparison. But just as many people are put off, because next year there will be something even better, so there is no harm in waiting, especially when things can go so badly wrong. Fisker was another new EV competitor that offered alternatives to the Tesla lineup, which has already gone out of business. Their cars were cost competitive, but they are now effectively worthless because their after-sales service no longer exists and highly technical proprietary EVs can't be worked on by independent third-party mechanics. Move fast and break things might work for a technology where cost overheads to the end user are zero, but the average new car costs almost $50,000 at the same time that most people are struggling to keep up with the cost of living. What people really want is a car that will move at all and won't break the bank. Now, it's not just EVs that are struggling to adapt to changing market dynamics. As the newest product offering in the market, they are being upgraded the fastest, especially since a lot of automakers have scaled back research and development into internal combustion engines. But old-fashioned cars have created their own problems too. Cars are simultaneously lasting longer and shorter at the same time. A study by the auto market data firm CAP-HBI in the mid-2010s found that the life cycle of new cars is now significantly shorter than it was in past decades, with the average new model only taking 2 years before an upgraded model comes along. A lot of models receive a refresh every single year, where manufacturers will make small changes to styling, infotainment, and make small drivetrain tweaks to differentiate between model years. More frequent regulation changes around emissions and safety has made these equally more frequent updates necessary. But obviously, I don't need to tell you that if brands can make last year's model look obsolete with some styling changes, they will do it. The number of different car models available in the market has also increased by over 50% in the last 20 years, fueled by both the introduction of new EV models, but also car brands trying to cover more of the market. 20 years ago, a Bentley, Aston Martin, or Ferrari SUV would have been a laughable idea, but now it's their best-selling car. This is happening across the industry as automakers try to cash in on their brand value to produce more mass market cars, if you consider a $500,000 V12 Ferrari commuter car mass market. Even at a regular price point, manufacturers are making a range of vehicle sizes, especially for SUVs where it's not unusual for a single brand to have four or five different model offerings from compact to full-size SUVs with several different trim and drivetrain options for each including full internal combustion, hybrids, and EVs within the same model. The end result is that across all price points, car manufacturers are making more cars, which are being updated more often, while having to adhere to more regulations across more markets, with more competition from more startups with more funding than they really should have. brands are having to allocate a lot of money to R&D to stay relevant. And if they can't keep up, even big global brands like Nissan have quickly lost market share. Now, not every car company has the luxury of selling their cars at a loss, so this growing business expense is being passed along to customers. The inconvenient truth about new technology is that, sometimes, it's kind of crap. Toyota has become the world's best-selling car brand largely thanks to their legendary reputation for reliability. Generally, Toyota develops cars very slowly, which means that models have long production runs, and even if something is a bit outdated, they will keep it around as long as it's reliable. The combination of reliability and the very fact that their cars don't normally look that different year to year has also helped them maintain very strong secondhand prices, which doesn't directly help the company, but it does mean that it has a diehard customer base that won't drive anything else. But even legendary Toyota has not been immune from this disruption sweeping the car market. They have had to move with the times and phase out a lot of their big, lazy, inefficient, but extremely reliable engines and replace them with smaller, more highly strung alternatives. This change has caused several extremely high-profile engine failures, which have tarnished the brand's invincible reputation. Now, by the numbers, Toyota's reliability is still class-leading. But a viral video of someone's new $30,000 Corolla burning down on the side of the highway sticks with the average consumer more than the numbers do. Now, apart from the people that are happy to lease the newest car every 2 years, this market is not great for anybody. Most car buyers just want a simple, reliable car to get them around. Most companies want to provide it to them. Even the investors are playing a billion-dollar game of last man standing, and it's all because some industries just don't need to be disrupted. So most companies have not been having a great year so far, but none are feeling the pain quite as much as car manufacturers. Of course, Tesla has been getting most of the attention as its stock price has plummeted by more than 50% since its peak late last year. Sales across the world have plummeted, as the brand has become an unintentional political statement. A political statement that doesn't really vibe with the type of people that buy electric cars. But the truth is that most other car companies are happy to let Tesla soak up the headlines, because under the proverbial hood, they have a lot of problems of their own. Major brand bankruptcies are now basically inevitable. Will they, won't they trade wars are crippling supply chains, new manufacturers from China are undercutting global markets, and worst of all, people just simply can't afford to buy cars right now. And in response to this simple financial reality, automakers have responded by making their cars more expensive than ever before.
It's told Honda it wants to call off merger talks. That's according to a Reuters source on Thursday.
Honda, Mitsubishi, and Nissan had been in talks to form a joint holding company, but ultimately they could not agree on terms.
For buyers with limited income or credit scores, Jessica Caldwell of Edmunds says more Americans are opting for longer repayment plans.
And finally, Bill, for folks who are really struggling, you know I always say this one, pick up the phone, call your lender, let them know the truth. You're struggling and you need help.
So the simple reality for most people in America is they can't responsibly afford to own a car. But they also can't afford not to own a car. The Federal Aid Highway Act of 1956 built out the American interstate system and decidedly made most cities extremely car-centric. These new highways connected cities, and lobbying from automobile manufacturers pushed local public transport out of the way in favor of car-friendly streets. The adoption of the car also let mostly middle-class white Americans move out of cities and into newly developed single-family suburbs built around independent transportation. According to data from the U.S. Census and the American Public Transport Association, 92% of American households own a car, but only 55% have access to any form of public transportation. And even for those that do, it's not always reliable or practical. Now, this has hurt the finances of a lot of households in truly unprecedented ways over the last 7 decades, but it has been fantastic for business. America has had the world's most valuable car market for most of the last century. Today, we have been overtaken by China, who buys roughly twice as many cars as we do. But they also have almost 5 times as many people, so it's not really fair. We also, on average, buy much larger and more expensive cars. Even though China buys twice as many vehicles, total market revenue is roughly the same because we spend almost twice as much on every car. A lot of our most popular models are so large that they can't even be sold into other major markets. But automakers don't mind because in the past, they have been able to make so much money from the American market that these vehicles are worth making even if they can't be sold anywhere else. Either by choice or necessity, we Americans are also far more willing to take on debt to purchase a new vehicle, often rolling equity from one vehicle into a down payment for a new vehicle with a new loan. Auto loans are now at a record $1.6 trillion, more than double what they were just a decade ago, back when rates were also a lot lower. So yeah, America has a dangerous obsession with big cars and risky personal debt, I know what you're thinking. That's not exactly groundbreaking journalism. But a unique mix of record-high debt, high interest rates, collapsing secondhand values, high sticker prices, stagnating purchasing power, and uncertain economic conditions might mean that the car market has created its own reckoning. So it's time to learn how money works to find out how much further the car market can stretch itself. This week's video is sponsored by Delete Me. Ever get that eerie feeling that the internet knows too much about you? That's not paranoia, it's data brokers. These companies collect and sell your personal information, like your name, address, phone number, and even info about your relatives, without your consent. Anyone can look you up, and that info just keeps spreading. That's why I started using Delete Me. It's a privacy service that tracks down where your data is being sold online and actually removes it, for real. They scan hundreds of data broker sites, file the removal requests, and keep monitoring in case your info pops back up. I personally use Delete Me, and I've been impressed by how much stuff they've already taken down. My first privacy report showed dozens of sites that had my details, and seeing that list shrink felt like taking control back. I'm not off the internet entirely, because let's be real, that's not really possible, but I'm a whole lot harder to find. If you're thinking about your own digital footprint or your family's, Delete Me's family plan makes sure your loved one's data stays protected too. It's something I wish I'd started doing sooner. Get 20% off Delete Me consumer plans when you go to joindeleteme.com/HMWU and use promo code HMWU at checkout. That's deleteme.com/HMWU, code HMWU. The price of an average new car has increased much faster than average wages. To date, the average car would set you back just under $50,000, which is only $9,000 shy of the average annual salary, before taxes. Buying the car is also just step one. Insurance and maintenance on increasingly technical cars has also become more expensive over time. So, how can people afford to spend their entire income on a car? Well, of course, they can't. According to data from the Fed, over 80% of new vehicle purchases today were done through financing, and dealerships have recognized this as one of their primary profit centers. The average dealership today is more of a loan shop with an occasional side hustle of selling some cars, and over time, they have become increasingly creative with how they will finance a vehicle. In the bad old days, people would just save up and buy a car. And then auto loans became more popular as other costs ate into average household budgets. People still had to put money down, but it was a way to make the car buying process less of an upfront commitment. Today, dealerships will use the equity in a half-paid-off car as the down payment for the next new car as long as the entire transaction goes through them. This is, or was, incredibly profitable, because it let dealerships make a little bit of margin from the new car sale, the used car trade-in, and the financing. But this financing treadmill has now put the whole market in a very difficult position. Used car prices spiked during the pandemic as supply chain breakdowns caused shortages. This let people trade in their old cars at higher prices to put down payments on more expensive new cars. If you were lucky and had a popular model back then, you might have been able to get more for your 3 to 5 year old car than you had spent on it when it was new. Now, the trade-off was that new cars were hard to buy and often came with dealership markups to account for market pricing. Now, this wasn't a problem back then, but it is a problem now as those cars try to repeat the cycle of rolling debt into new purchases. The average price of a used car has fallen considerably because supplies are no longer a major issue, and budget-conscious used car buyers don't have as much disposable income as they did 3 to 4 years ago with low interest rates and stimulus checks. And if things were looking bad for gas cars, it's significantly worse for EVs, but more on that soon. This means people are still underwater with the cars they have purchased with significant markups back in 2022. Some of these people can't even afford to sell their car without putting their own money down to clear their debt, let alone use the equity in their car to buy a new car. To make matters worse, car companies noticed the markups that customers were willing to pay the dealerships and wanted some of that action for themselves. When it was difficult to get enough components to keep up with demand, car companies started prioritizing higher trim variations of the same model to maximize the revenue on higher margin units. Optional extras like driver aids, sunroofs, heated and cooled seats, better sound systems, and infotainment are all sold at a significant markup from their component costs. In some cars, these components are installed anyway, and the features are just manually disabled for customers who didn't select the optional extra. So manufacturers really liked creating these higher spec vehicles. This trend quickly resulted in the market today, where affordable new cars, even from previously economy-focused brands, are all but extinct. And mid-range brands are now marketing themselves as competitors in the much more lucrative luxury market. Now, this is not unique to just the car market. A lot of companies have either gone down market to focus on a growing number of cost-conscious consumers or have taken their entire brand up market. We've mentioned it before, but it's worth repeating. that the wealthiest 10% of households now account for 50% of all the spending done in the economy and are responsible for all of the economic growth. But the thing with the car market, and you are going to have to trust my math on this, but the top 10% of income earners only actually makes up 10% of the population. And even then, not all high-income households are interested in buying premium vehicles. Yes, some high-income earners have car collections, but this is still a very rare minority. As car equity dries up, interest rates have jumped, and new cars have become more expensive, it's become harder for dealerships to get deals done. Now, according to data from the Bureau of Economic Analysis, car sales have fallen, but not significantly. We are buying about 1 to 2 million fewer cars every year than we did before the pandemic. Not great, not terrible, right? Well, not exactly. All of these market conditions have combined with one unfortunate reality. Cars are just getting better. According to the S&P Global Mobility Survey, the average age of cars on the road in the US has increased by 3 years in just the last decade. It's increased by 2 years in just the past 4 years alone. This means people aren't buying new cars as often, and vehicle sales have been helped a lot by cars being sold 3 or 4 times over in their life rather than just once or twice when vehicles don't last as long. New cars might have more features on them that can go wrong, but generally the essential stuff like bodies and drivetrains are far more robust than they have ever been. And yes, I can already hear some of you typing in the comments about Nissan CVTs. There are always bad examples, but generally it's never been a better time to be a used car buyer. The average person will happily deal with some outdated electronics or broken infotainment if they have a reliable form of transportation. This has also encouraged new car buyers to seek out more reliable brands because even though they might have a warranty for the entire length of their ownership, the market perception of reliability can have a big impact on resale price. Companies like Stellantis, which makes Alfa Romeo, Dodge, Jeep, Ram, and Chrysler, have been hit by this from every direction. They played a lot of funny business with financing and dealer markups when they could, and their cars are consistently rated as some of the least reliable on the market. This is also a real problem for their ambitions to make their cars look like a luxury competitor, because when people think of Jeep, they don't think of a luxury SUV. They think of their broke cousin who bought a clapped out Wrangler off Facebook Marketplace for $2,800 and a lawnmower, as a completely random example. Now, it might almost be satisfying to see bad manufacturers who cut costs and jacked up prices to feel some consequences, but there are some bigger factors at play here that will unfortunately most likely end up hurting regular people who just need a way to get around. Most car companies are not allowed to simply fail. They employ too many people in valuable jobs, and in a lot of countries with large auto industries, they are a significant export staple. Too big to fail is not unique to the car industry, but struggling car makers are often the first sight of bad things coming as they depend on finance, global trade, consumer confidence, labor, and resource prices to all play nice in order to run a profitable car company. We are already seeing governments step in to ease these problems. Nissan is a failing company. Their sales have slumped as their lineup has aged and brand perception is at an all-time low thanks to a series of very public problems with critical drivetrain components. The problems are also worse than the dismal sales trend alone would suggest because a lot of volume from this brand has come from extremely aggressive financing. Even when everybody else was arguably pushing car financing too far, Nissan stood out as a brand that would ride a loan on a new Maxima to basically anybody. The company also made a lot of sales to rental car fleets by offering aggressive bulk purchase discounts on their economy cars. This was a nice way to boost sales at the time, but rental car companies normally only keep their vehicles for 2 to 3 years before dumping them on the used market. This caused resale prices to tank on used Nissans because so many hit the market at the same time. Now, this wouldn't normally be Nissan's problem. However, in an effort to make sales, the company introduced a financing promotion where they would ensure the future value of their cars in certain markets around the world so they were on the hook to buy their cars back at above value. They got away with this for a while when used car prices were high, but it's a significant hidden liability for a company already struggling with debt. Nissan had effectively gorged itself with short-term wins, and now it's facing complete insolvency. The Japanese government had not so subtly tried to fix these problems by playing matchmaker in a proposed merger between Honda and Nissan. The deal was promoted as a merger of equals, which would create one of the largest manufacturers in the world. But nobody took this seriously. Honda had better sales, better brand perception, they were in a better financial situation, better products, and had better management. It was a merciful way to save thousands of jobs in Japan and across the world. Now, this particular deal fell through, likely signifying the beginning of the end for Nissan, but similar interventions are likely going to become more common as other automakers deal with the same kind of problems. So yeah, dumb companies played stupid games and won stupid prizes. And unfortunately, workers are going to be the ones to feel it the worst. However, hot take alert, but we all share some blame in this as well. Cars are something that you and I, and everybody watching, are terrible at purchasing rationally. Whether we like to admit it or not, we do see the cars that we drive as a reflection of ourselves and the image we want to present to the world. Whether it's an EV to show that your RSUs got paid out, a lifted truck to show the Walmart parking lot who's boss, or a Chrysler Pacifica to show you have given up, cars are inevitably a way to communicate what we are about with total strangers. Even those people who have already left a comment talking about their 1996 Toyota Camry and how it's never going to die have still purchased an image. Their image is pretending to be better than the people who care too much about the car they are driving. Yes, car companies have become really good at taking advantage of human weakness, but we keep on falling for it. Their ads are almost always about how their cars are seen, rather than what they do, and it's all to show potential buyers how they can be seen. But as we are exposed to more advertising and social media where everybody is showing off their best life, this is resulting in some pretty alarming trends. Multiple surveys conducted on US and global car buyers found that Gen Zs, who are currently aged between 13 and 30, are the generation most likely to purchase a luxury car, despite having the lowest overall net worth, lowest incomes, and highest proportional levels of debt. Tragically, a lot of people in this generation are realizing very quickly that they may never be able to achieve financial independence or even financial stability. As a way to compensate for that, they are doing the next best thing, which is buying an expensive car to at least roleplay as people who aren't getting financially fucked from every angle. Now, the good news is yes, car companies can use brand perception to sell us on financially irrational purchases, but those same perceptions can come back to hurt them just as fast. So yeah, we gotta talk about Tesla. From its all-time peak, the company has lost more than $500 billion in market capitalization in less than 3 months. Uncertainty around trade wars, competition in global markets from highly competitive Chinese EVs, a general consumer shift back to internal combustion engines, and broader market slowdowns have all hurt the world's most valuable automaker. But let's be honest, whether you love him or hate him, Elon Musk is inextricably linked with the company's brand image. He has gone from someone who could be the sole marketing strategy for the entire company to an individual that is pushing a lot of people who would consider buying an EV away from the brand. Now, other car companies are probably really happy he is getting all of this attention, because even though it's a lot slower, people are pushing back against the idea of owning a car at all. Walkable cities, public transport, shorter commutes, and car sharing have all become much more popular issues across America. And while we have a lot of work to undo 7 decades of car-centric planning, having no car is becoming just as fashionable as having a fancy car. So the solution to the problem of unaffordable housing seems so simple, right? Just build more houses. Well, we have been. New construction is approaching the highest rate it has ever been since the 2008 crash. And that's despite record high construction costs that came about because of disrupted supply chains. The problem has been if we were building the right kind of housing. As costs rose and margin shrank, the only kind of property that remained profitable to build was luxury property. And now we have found ourselves in a strange situation. We might have too many houses. Now I know what you're thinking. Sounds great, right? Wrong. Despite all of this new development, we are still short about 4 million homes by most estimates. And if developers can't sell the luxury homes they have already built, it's much less likely we will build the other homes we actually need.
Landlords could be left holding the bag, and renters, unless something really big happens, could go homeless.
These landlords are on the verge of bankruptcy of these apartment buildings behind me and across America.
This is what $218 million buys you in Palm Beach, Florida.
The luxury rental market is crashing.
Half of all renters in the U.S. are paying more in rent than they should.
Sold anything that I had that's worth selling to try to make ends meet.
So there's actually a bit more to the numbers of new homes we are building. But what is clear is that in America in particular, we have been building way more apartments. 2 years ago, we actually broke the all-time record for the total number of new apartments built within a year, a record that has been held since the 1970s. That last spike was caused by demand from baby boomers entering the housing market for the first time. They wanted cheaper places closer to city centers instead of the Levittown-style suburbia they were raised in. These new apartments were pretty good. They were mostly well-built with relatively large floor plans that could easily accommodate larger families. This was helped by government-subsidized housing programs that meant developers could always rely on someone to sell or rent to. Largely, though, it was simply supply increasing to meet demand. This building boom eventually collapsed because of the recession of 1973. the oil crisis, the end of Bretton Woods, and new international competition all took turns beating on the US economy, making it more expensive to build for people with less money to buy new apartments. By the time the market had recovered, the baby boomers had largely lost interest in apartments and were moving back into the suburbs, only this time with much bigger houses. Potential spoiler alert, but at that time, we didn't realize we were in a recession until the end of 1974. New property construction has consistently been more in tune with the economy than the economists. So anyway, the most recent construction boom was fueled by a lot of things. New construction had recovered after the 2008 crash, and people were once again interested in living in apartments. According to a report by the Harris Poll, dual-income no-kids or DINK households have become the fastest group of homebuyers in America. Both people working makes low-maintenance apartments ideal, and the lack of kids means there is less need for extra space that typically comes with a single-family freestanding home. DINK households also have more spending power on average, so accommodating them with new property developments became very profitable. Young cash-up renters or buyers were more likely to pay a premium for expensive-looking fittings, fixtures, materials, designs, and amenities in their apartment. Builders loved this, because a faux marble waterfall countertop and a few treadmills tucked into a corner room somewhere were very cheap to include in a build, but properties could then be sold at a much higher markup than typical budget-friendly housing, even if the apartments themselves were exactly the same size. Interest rates were also very low. Builders usually take out construction loans to finance the land purchase and the actual building of the structure. Once this is complete, there are various options for developers to get their money back, but the interest rate during construction is extremely important. For a little while, new apartment construction started to stagnate as interest rates were raised around 2016, but then everything changed when the COVID-19 attacked. Immediately following global lockdowns, starting new construction was very difficult, but quickly, a few extra factors made apartments a hot commodity. People took remote work opportunities to move to different cities at a record rate. Add in stimulus, low interest rates, booming asset markets, and young adults who didn't feel like being stuck inside with their parents 24 hours a day, and it was the perfect storm for developers to make some money. New luxury apartment buildings sprung up across the country, often accompanied by flashy marketing campaigns to attract renters and buyers. The biggest factor of all, though, was that the developers didn't need to hold onto these buildings. Once constructed and rented out, the whole building could be packaged up and sold to a financial institution that would put them into a residential real estate investment trust, which would then be sold onto other investors who wanted exposure to a broad portfolio of real estate without actually having to manage the real estate directly. These REITs are not new, but they have grown in popularity, especially for residential real estate. This worked well to encourage building, but you might have already noticed that it sounds very familiar. For the builders and lenders, once heads were in beds, they didn't really care what happened to the building because it wasn't their asset anymore. Unsurprisingly, a lot of this new luxury housing turned out to be not so luxurious after all, and that was really the least of its problems. Millions of jobs, from architects to plumbers, rely on building these homes. Financial institutions have invested heavily into them, and even beyond the finances, this is all very dependent on these buildings not falling apart within the next 20 years. Okay, so clearly a lot of this luxury housing is not actually luxury housing. It's just expensive housing with a bit of a marketing budget. Those aren't always the same thing. Extremely large but poorly designed and cheaply built homes are not a new feature in most suburbs around the world, especially here in America. McMansions, as they are affectionately known, appeal to a market of buyers who don't have an endless budget but still want a house with a 4-car garage, a billiards room, 2 guest bedrooms, and an extra formal living room that never gets used. The solution was houses with a lot of square footage but very low cost per square foot. This normally means sacrifices are made in materials, insulation, and build quality. Long term, that makes these homes very expensive to maintain, but the upfront cost for the space you are getting is almost unbeatable. Or at least, it was unbeatable until supply chain disruptions made building materials extremely expensive. No matter how many corners are cut, bigger homes are just going to take more materials. According to the National Association of Home Builders, the average price of a new home in 2024 was $428,000, which means in most areas, it's simply not financially viable to build a new home, since an established house plus the land it's sitting on could be purchased for just as much. That has meant that the new wave of luxury housing development has mostly been in the form of apartment buildings, which have effectively just become McMansions in the sky. At the extreme high end, there are developments like 432 Park Avenue, 157, The Shore Club, and Central Park Tower. These high-rises, mainly along Billionaires Row in Manhattan, have sold individual apartments for hundreds of millions of dollars to people like Michael Dell, Ken Griffin, and everybody's second favorite Twitter shitposter, Bill Ackman. Below that, there are a new wave of premium developments with accommodations ranging from $1.5 to $10 million in most large cities across the country. Households in the top 10% of incomes already account for half of all consumption in America, and they are willing to pay a lucrative premium for new upmarket housing. Then, there's the largest group of these new developments, which are pretty much just investor stock apartments with nice-sounding names like the Concord or the Bayview. These are primarily mid-rise or 5-over-1 style developments, made to a budget for the express intention of being a financial asset with the added side effect of giving some people a place to live. Thanks to a change in building codes around fireproof construction following the 2008 crash, 5-over-1 developments became much easier to build. This bottom floor is typically dedicated to retail spaces, and then atop that, there are 4 to 5 stories of wood frame construction for apartments. These buildings per square meter are some of the cheapest structures to build, and have become the most profitable to develop because they were possible to sell or rent at a significant markup over their building costs, and then they made the perfect risk-reward asset to put in the portfolio of institutions that have purchased thousands of these multifamily dwellings. Additionally, the retail space below gives a secondary rental income stream that is not directly correlated with the residential market. Now, hot take alert, but yes, these buildings often do look very ugly. But at a time when we are desperate for more housing, we might not have the luxury of being too picky about aesthetics. However, there are 2 other problems that are far more serious than some gaudy facades. The first problem is that the people constructing the buildings are a long way removed from the people who will eventually own them. A developer will normally subcontract a builder who will subcontract tradesmen who will actually do the construction. The developer will either then sell the building to individual apartment owners, or more likely, they will sell it to a firm that aggregates these buildings before selling them as a portfolio to an investment fund, which will further bundle them up to sell them as a residential real estate investment fund, which will be sold to retirement funds, which will be sold to you. That is assuming you have retirement savings. Now, the financialization of the real estate market never hurt anybody before, right? But it does mean that building standards have consistently been lacking because all of the groups involved just want to build to a set budget before passing the hot potato of responsibility along to the next person. This has happened across all of these tiers of luxury housing. Even ultra-luxury developments like the Trash Can Tower at 432 Park Avenue are riddled with structural issues leading to lengthy lawsuits just to figure out who is ultimately responsible for fixing the problems. Now, obviously, in a building where the average apartment sold for more than $10 million, the residents will have the time and resources to take a property developer to court. But a lot of other less high-profile property buyers don't have that luxury if their hastily constructed home falls apart. The second problem with these new developments is something that affects you even if you never buy, build, or invest in these properties. Higher density housing needs higher density services to deal with traffic, waste management, schools, and emergency services. These have to be supplied by the municipality, not the developer. And property dues on these units are normally much lower than freestanding single-family homes. To be clear, mid to high-density housing is much more fiscally manageable than suburban sprawls, which requires proportionally more roads and connecting services. But the boom in new apartments are still a significant short-term expense that has to be accounted for even if they are cheaper in the long term. But then there's the biggest problem of all with this new luxury living space. Nobody wants to live in it. Because of the luxury branding, many of these new units are more expensive than homes that are much larger. This is especially the case for larger apartments with enough bedrooms for families with children. A 4-bedroom home is a pretty typical staple of most American suburbs. A 4-bedroom apartment is a penthouse that commands an ultra-luxury premium. If you enjoy a good doom scroll on Zillow, try and find a 4-bedroom apartment in your city or town that costs less than the average 4-bedroom home. As new buildings are finished, they are further saturating a market that has done too much too quickly. In certain cities, developers are now offering multiple months of free rent, or concessions like holidays or jewelry for people who sign year-long leases in their new buildings. Now, you have probably already asked the logical question, which is that if nobody is renting these places unless they are given freebies, why don't they just make their rent cheaper instead? Well, they can't. Yes, according to some rigorous calculations, $2,000 a month in rent for a year with 3 months free is the same as just charging $1,500 a month. But the number crunchers don't see it this way. Most of these buildings will be sold based on a multiple of how much income they are generating, something known as the capitalization rate, or cap rate. In non-financial jargon, this is what percent of the purchase price a building returns in income every year. So a $10 million building returning $500,000 a year in income would have a cap rate of 5%. Or, put another way, if investors are willing to accept a 5% cap rate, which is generally where the market has been heading, then a building returning $500,000 a year is worth $10 million. But if those apartments are rented out at a higher base rate and are returning $600,000 a year, then the building is worth an extra $2 million. It looks much better on paper to have an apartment rented out for $2,000 because that can be multiplied by 15 or 25 to give an appropriate sales price. And then the valuers don't need to know about the special deals made earlier in the lease. Now, the institutions buying these multi-million dollar properties aren't stupid. They know this is happening, but they don't really care because they know that once people have moved into a home, they don't typically want to leave if they can avoid it. According to NerdWallet, the average cost to move houses is more than $1,700. And on top of that, it's a major pain in the ass. Even if people do move out because their rent gets too expensive, that doesn't really matter. Because by the time that happens, the building would have been securitized and sold onto some faceless REIT investor. Now, there is one other reason why the whole industry is desperate to make these numbers look as good as possible as quickly as possible. A lot of these new constructions were financed back when rates were very cheap, and most construction loans only last between 3 and 5 years before they need to be refinanced. Unless they start generating an income, these buildings will be very hard to refinance, meaning that a lot of highly leveraged developers could find themselves in a very dangerous situation. The most disappointing about this whole trend is that medium-density housing is desperately needed in America. It's probably the best way to address the problems of endless urban sprawl, car dependence, and unaffordable housing. Unfortunately, we have implemented a good idea in the dumbest way possible. Affordable housing has become the defining challenge of this generation, not only in America, but across the world. House prices have grown so much faster than wages that young people will struggle for years just to save for a down payment. Also, they can struggle for decades to make the repayments on their mortgage. At the same time, we are told that our home is our biggest asset. And the last time the real estate market saw a significant dip, it took the global economy down with it. So, can we make houses affordable without destroying the economy?
I know the cost of housing is so important to you.
We want home ownership to be a reality.
We introduced a new incentive program to help first-time home buyers get into the market.
According to data from the U.S. Census Bureau, the home ownership rate in America is 65%. So the majority of people have a direct financial interest in not seeing their biggest financial asset lose its value. This is in spite of the fact that according to a study by the Cato Institute, 87% of Americans are worried about the cost of housing, which means there is a big overlap between people who want affordable housing, as long as it's not theirs. This means that the only winning course of action for politicians is to performatively make the problem worse. The Biden administration has announced plans to offer tax credits of up to $10,000 to families selling their home to another owner-occupant, in addition to another tax credit of up to $5,000 to offset mortgage rates for first-time homebuyers. These could be used in conjunction with a $25,000 bonus for first-generation homebuyers. But if you are a new buyer and get $40,000 worth of extra tax bonuses and grants, all that will do is make affordable housing $40,000 more expensive, which doesn't really make you any better off overall. It is great for existing property owners, though. This has been tried in other countries like Australia and Canada, and it did not work as a long-term solution, although it did allow for Richard to Airbnb his basement and use the proceeds to buy a McLaren. In fact, their real estate market is even more fucked than ours. Presumably, the only reason Patrick Boyle has filmed all of his videos in random offices and classrooms is because he couldn't afford the rent on his flat in London on his modest income as a hedge fund manager. Most policies that aim to give more purchasing power to new buyers really only benefit existing owners, even if it does let politicians score some easy points in the short term. So, if you can't make houses more affordable by increasing people's buying power, then the only option left is to make houses more affordable by lowering their prices. This sounds simple, but it can cause some big problems. If house prices collapse too quickly, it can leave people underwater on their home loans, where the money they owe to the bank is worth more than the house itself. This can destabilize the financial system and the economy that depends on it, because it makes lending highly risky if debt can't be secured against real assets and some people choose to just walk away from their homes. This can have knock-on effects that will impact every aspect of your financial life. The people who will be hurt most by a housing crash are people who have only just purchased their first home and still have a large mortgage on it, since they have the smallest equity buffer before their mortgage is worth more than their house. People who have owned their home for a long time and have a small or no mortgage won't be hurt and might even just enjoy the lower property taxes. Sacrificing the people on the bottom rung of the housing ladder to let more people grab on isn't a good idea, and it weirdly doesn't even make houses affordable. This was the situation for many American households in 2008. Even though house prices in some areas more than halved, the actual rate of home ownership over that time also fell significantly. So just making houses cheaper isn't enough to make houses more affordable, unless you look at some radical and not so radical solutions that won't be politically popular, but just might work. There are solutions that could actually make houses cheaper and keep them cheaper, and the political will to take these drastic steps is growing every day. You see, this chart here doesn't tell the full story. The spike here wasn't a bunch of new people buying a home and then selling it again. It was mostly young people moving back in with their parents at the start of the pandemic. This chart only measures the percentage of Americans that live in an owner-occupied home. It doesn't account for if they actually own it. According to data collected from the U.S. Census Bureau and compiled by USA Facts, the number of people aged between 25 and 34 still living at home with their parents peaked to an all-time high in 2020 and has remained near historic highs. Most young adults in this age group would prefer a place of their own, but house prices and rent have made it financially challenging for most and outright impossible for many. So we might soon have enough people to start demanding more drastic steps. One solution that has gained a lot of attention in recent years is a land value tax that, as the name suggests, would charge property owners on the value of their land, but not on the value of the property as a whole. A land value tax doesn't consider the value of buildings and improvements on top of the land. It just accounts for the value of the land itself and charges whoever owns that land a percentage of its value every year, just like you pay a percentage of your income every year. There are details to be hammered out over exactly how much that percentage should be and if it should be progressive like income taxes. For example, someone that owns their family home on a lot worth $500,000 might have to pay 1% or $5,000 every year in a land value tax. But a wealthy landlord that owns 50 single-family homes that are collectively worth $25 million might have to pay a 4% rate or $1 million every year. With the right fine-tuning, this system, which was first popularized by economist Henry George, promises to fix a lot of society's problems, including housing. In his most famous book, Progress and Poverty, George argued that a land value tax could be a country's only tax if it was managed well enough. The name of the book sounds about as depressing as your average How Money Works video, but it became so popular in the late 19th century that an entire political movement grew up around it, today known simply as Georgism. Supporters of Georgism make some big promises, but for now, you only need to focus on one aspect, which is that it should make housing more affordable. Adding a tax to something to make it more affordable might be a little bit counterintuitive, but if landowners have to pay a portion of their land's value every year in tax, they have a strong incentive to maximize returns on that land or otherwise sell it to someone who could. The land value tax on a completely empty lot should theoretically be the same as the land value tax on a lot next door that has a 50-unit apartment building on it collecting 50 sets of rent. The owner of the vacant lot is motivated to either sell their land or build something on it to generate income to offset the tax that they are paying to own the land because they pay the same tax no matter what. This could act as a way to discourage vast landholding purely for capital appreciation because it makes it a lot less profitable to sit and hold onto empty real estate. A broad land value tax could also offset income taxes, which means regular working people will have more disposable income to put towards buying houses. Traditional Georgism actually argued that a land value tax could replace income taxes entirely, but even if you don't believe that is possible, it would still help. If the average house is worth $1 million, that is not actually a problem if the average worker is making $250,000. But in reality, house prices have massively outpaced increases in wages since the 1970s. A land value tax could rebalance this in three ways. The first way is by reducing income taxes since the government would get an alternative source of revenue. It's up to you to decide if they would really pass that along though. The second way is by making real estate a less attractive buy and hold investment, pushing more supply onto the market by getting people to actually do something with their land instead of treating it like a buy and hold investment. The third way it could close this widening gap is to encourage people to invest into actual businesses that make stuff and employ people rather than buying and holding land. More business investment instead of more real estate speculation should increase worker productivity and by extension wages, closing the gap between income and house prices. Perhaps the best part of all of this is that it can be done slowly, so that house prices don't collapse overnight, which would just make things worse for regular people. The challenge with this is political. People don't like taxes, and without sitting everyone down and forcing them to read the work of Henry George, you are going to struggle to sell this to voters when big landowners can easily lobby against it by talking about poor hardworking farmers and retirees that are going to be forced out of their home by another tax. The moral justification of a land value tax is that a country belongs to its people, and if you specifically want the exclusive use of a bit of that country as your own private property, you owe a little bit of rent to everybody else in the country for using land that belongs to them. It makes sense, but it's not going to be politically popular. It is also more government interference in the free market, thumbing the scale in favor of one type of investor over another. But that's actually the point. Even if widespread land value tax is never going to happen, at the very least, taxes that currently favor real estate over business investment should entirely be scrapped. Real estate-specific government perks like 1031 exchanges, reduced capital gains, opportunity zones, negative gearing, pass-throughs, deferments, deductions, tax credits, home buyers plans, government-backed mortgages, and home office write-offs are all kind of like a negative land tax which shifts government incentives in favor of hoarding as much land as possible. With this many perks, you shouldn't really be surprised that people buy real estate as an investment. The other weakness of a land value tax is that it assumes that people with land holdings wouldn't already be building housing on them to maximize their rental income if they could. But they can't. So, the second solution to making houses more affordable without destroying the economy is simply to build more houses. Zoning, NIMBYism, HOAs, a long list of confusing codes, and a lack of skilled tradesmen has made building a home a major ordeal. The sign of a successful economy is that it can produce things like a computer, a car, or a house efficiently and for a competitive price. We have convinced ourselves that houses are somehow special, and that them being limited and expensive is a positive characteristic. According to census data, America is building fewer houses today than we were in the 1970s, even though our population has almost doubled. Building houses does more than just increase the supply of an essential commodity. It also gives lots of jobs to lots of people because building homes and the utilities that support them require real hands-on work. Now, just building more houses won't solve all of our problems. American cities have a major problem with urban sprawl. Building a house an hour away from a city center with no public transport or local amenities just replaces one problem with another. But we can fix this by building medium-density housing for people who just want a decent place to live. People are pro new medium-density home construction nationally, but are anti-construction locally. According to a survey conducted by the US Census Bureau, home equity is simply considered as most households' most significant asset, so most people don't want housing supplies diluted, especially in their local area with cheaper alternatives. I don't think I really need to convince you that building more houses to fix a housing shortage is an important step, but it probably won't be enough by itself. China has built more houses than any other country on the planet in the last 20 years, and they have homes that are even more unaffordable than ours. Yes, they have a lot of people, but their building spree more than made up for this. China built so many new homes that thousands of new developments and millions of apartments are sitting empty in so-called ghost cities that exist just for people to own a home. In China, a home is not just people's biggest investment. It's their only investment. According to an analysis by JP Morgan's private banking division, Chinese real estate was the single largest asset class in the world as of 2021. And that's exactly the problem. It was a financial asset first, and a place for people to live second. A lot of the housing constructed in China in the last 20 years you couldn't even live in. It was an empty concrete box with no utilities and a tower with no people. It was a financial asset in the world's biggest filing cabinet. But learning from those mistakes can show us the third way to make housing affordable without destroying the economy. China is experiencing a significant slowdown because of how much emphasis they put on real estate as a financial asset. But here in America, we are making the same mistakes. Companies are turning family homes into financial assets that can be bundled up and traded on securities markets like stocks, bonds, or options. According to data from Redfin, investors purchased more than a quarter of affordable homes sold in America last quarter, which was an all-time high. Investors include anybody from someone purchasing their first investment property all the way up to Invitation Homes buying their 100,000th home. The number of single-family homes owned by large corporate investors is still less than 2% of total housing stock and a small share of home purchases. But before COVID, it was less than 1%. Whatever the investor looks like, real estate has become too attractive as a financial asset, because rents are high and the government has demonstrated that they won't let prices fall, precisely because the real estate market has become too big to fail. Definancializing real estate could be as simple as an outright ban on corporate ownership of family homes. If my community polls are an indicator of national sentiment, it's one of the first solutions that would be politically popular. Just reining in lending could also put the brakes on property investors who see real estate as a way to leverage their way into an overnight fortune by extracting rent rather than investing in something productive. To be fair, the financial system is just as guilty. If you want to take out a 5-to-1 leveraged position to start a business that will employ people, a bank would laugh you out of a branch. But ask for a 50-to-1 leveraged position on a home, and you will have financial firms fighting for your business. In the early 2000s, something remarkable happened. The video game industry brought in more revenue than the movie industry. At this time, video games had only been around for a few decades at most, and most media companies still viewed them as a toy to entertain children and computer nerds. Today, the video game industry is worth more than the movie and music industry combined, and the companies that make these games are some of the most valuable businesses in the world. The only thing is, they don't really make video games anymore. Movie studios are pumping out record numbers of big-budget movies, which are being viewed by more people on more platforms, but video game studios are doing the opposite. Video game companies don't make money producing video games anymore. In fact, game companies will try to do whatever they can to avoid producing new games because their businesses do better the less they make. I think a lot of you are already muttering microtransactions under your breath, but that's only half the story. Video games are a major industry, and their development has become a major business endeavor.
As I said, the industry's on fire. More people have recognized the value of games.
Cyberpunk 2077 cost CD Projekt Red $316 million to produce and market. This is more than only a handful of the biggest budget movies ever. It was also a poorly received video game, which tanked the game company's credibility with their audience and their stock price with their investors.
I'm sorry.
Their 2021 annual earnings report showed that they generated gross sales of $207 million from the title. They may go on to sell more copies as time passes, but so far, this game is shaping up to be a staggering loss for the company.
I and the entire leadership team are deeply sorry for this, and this video is me publicly owning up to that.
Now, you might think I'm cherry-picking a famously bad example, but many game publishers have found themselves investing heavily into AAA game titles only for them to fail upon launch. Fallout 76, Battlefield 2042, and Destiny all being big budget stinkers. AAA games have become incredibly complex to develop. They now require unique, dedicated work of thousands of people. The more moving parts these publishers try to put into their games, the more chances there are for things to go wrong. The original Halo, produced by a team of around 100 people, was quite substantial. Halo Infinite, which was released 2 decades later, had more than 100 voice actors. Video games becoming more expensive to produce is not, by itself, a problem. An industry this big is always going to have room for massive budgets, but if companies are going to make these investments, they need to be worthwhile.
Shut up and take my money!
Most big budget games, just like most big budget movies, do make money. But despite both being products designed to entertain people, movies and video games are very different. Most people will only ever watch a movie once or twice, whereas video games are designed to be played for hundreds of hours. Video game companies have learned to take advantage of this by selling more and more features to players as they continue to play. These microtransactions, for many titles, have become the primary revenue generator, with actual game sales being a nice little bonus. Some companies have made their games free to play because they know that more online players is more opportunities for them to sell virtual upgrades or cosmetic items on the game's marketplace. Releasing a new version of the game can cannibalize these potential sales as players move over to the new game with the new store. If Rockstar released Grand Theft Auto 6 this year, there is no doubt it would make a ton of money, but it would also reduce revenue coming in from Grand Theft Auto Online, the company's biggest earner. It might still be worth it, but it's a huge risk. The company would need to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to produce a new game and run the risk of it being a buggy mess.
It's the same engine,
right, that I worked on when I was there, the core of it, it's the same content. They've really perfected the systems. Again, there's a beautiful machine there that you'd have to try really hard to fuck up.
Not only can game companies lose a source of revenue from an upgrade, they can also annoy the big spenders, who would be left with hundreds of dollars worth of virtual items in an outdated video game. Rockstar would have a choice. Do they A, let people have all the stuff they paid for in Grand Theft Auto 5 and Grand Theft Auto 6, or do they B, make people start from scratch? Option A would mean that their new project is going to miss out on a lot of revenue from people who are happy to spend real-life money to have the coolest stuff the game has to offer. Leaving potential revenue on the table is not going to be popular with the investors that need to greenlight such a large project.
Around GTA 6. So the question is there, how do we think about remaster and console cycle potentially impacting the timing of GTA 6? And any interest in giving a year right here?
Right, so Rockstar hasn't announced any new titles for the market.
Option B will make the most financially valuable players angry if the new game doesn't have enough new features. They might not take the leap at all and choose to continue playing the old version with all of their stuff. On the topic of new features, putting them into games has become both easier for small projects and harder for larger ones. We have already seen that massively ambitious games chocked full of features where you can do everything have the potential to be massive embarrassments when even a few of these features don't work. The problem big game companies face is that they can't push these large projects without promising something to differentiate them from the long list of titles that already exist. There was a time when new features could be as simple as updated graphics. Gran Turismo games used to make headlines about what at the time looked like photorealistic graphics. Now, game development tools like Unreal Engine give developers access to high-end graphics right out of the box without the need for teams of developers to build a game from scratch. Not only is it harder for big-budget games to distinguish themselves on features, it's harder for them to justify their need at all.
Who said?
The marketing people.
Marketing? I thought we were supposed to have total creative control.
Welcome to the Matrix.
The original Doom launched in 1993, and quickly became the game people thought of when they thought of a combat video game. Less than 10 years later, in 2001, Halo Combat Evolved arguably stole that title and quickly became the most popular first-person shooter ever up until that point.
Shooter should really enjoy the game, as you know, should anyone. You know, besides being easily the best game of the Xbox launch, it's one of the best first-person shooters ever on any platform.
It was easy to see why. The technology was vastly different, and the overall immersion and enjoyability of the first Halo game was far greater than that of Doom. Now, 20 years later, people are still playing the first Halo game because it really has everything you could ever want in a shooter. Yes, the graphics are obviously dated, but the difference between Combat Evolved and the latest Halo game are significantly smaller than the differences between Combat Evolved and Doom. For many players, the nostalgia and lower hardware requirements of the older game are actually a draw. Companies are forced to get more and more ambitions in order to justify new games, and while technology can make some things possible that simply weren't 20 years ago, it still depends on an ever larger number of human developers to stuff these features into a game.
Video games have changed the course of human evolution to some degree.
When existing games exist that people are already perfectly happy with, they are also going to be far less accepting of any bugs or mistakes made by any of the thousands of developers now involved in bringing these games to life. Alright, so games have become more expensive and riskier to produce. Technology has hit a plateau where there is less need for new games to keep up, and game companies have found new ways to make money much more predictably. Now, I said at the beginning of this video that microtransactions were only half the story behind why game companies could get away with going so long between new big releases. Yes, it's true. If gamers were not happy to spend hundreds of dollars on a single game over many years, these companies would probably be forced to release more games to keep the money rolling in. In fact, the predatory monetization of video games is something I have already made a separate video on. But there is something else that has arguably been an even better business opportunity for the big players in the video game industry, and this is providing tools to other game developers. There is an old saying that if you want to get rich in a gold rush, you don't dig for gold, you sell the shovels. There are thousands of small game studios all trying to make the next PUBG or Fortnite. Some of them will make millions of dollars, and most of them will make very little money at all. Bigger games with more money behind them do have a better chance of making a return on their investment, but that is still digging for gold in a very crowded and competitive marketplace. Valve was once a very successful game studio. Now, producing games is just a side hustle for them, because they make more money running the Steam marketplace.
Why doesn't Valve make games anymore?
Because they don't have to, they have enough money.
They sure...
End of the news.
Epic Games also started off as a video game developer, but they have now branched out into running the Epic Game Store, as well as licensing the tools that they use to make their games to other aspiring developers. Unreal Engine costs $1,500 per developer per year. There are 22,000 self-reported video game businesses operating in America. Even if all of these companies had 5 developers each, that is over 100,000 Unreal Engine customers. Unreal Engine currently has 13% market share, meaning that Epic Games could be making $20 million in licensing fees alone, which is actually not that much, really. But Epic Games isn't done there. They actually intentionally make their software cheap to use. In many cases, they make it totally free. Why? Because they also charge a 5% royalty fee on any sales a game makes over $1 million. Just like free-to-play games are designed to bring in big spending players, Unreal's free-to-develop model is designed to bring in big earning titles. That 13% market share could be bringing in as much as $650 million from the American game market alone. Epic is a privately held company, so they do not release their financials, but it is estimated that the company earns more than $1 billion a year worldwide from their game engine alone. Some other companies have taken a less technical approach to generate new income streams. Some of the biggest names in gaming, like EA and Ubisoft, have just acquired dozens of smaller game studios. Not only does this share overhead costs amongst lots of different projects, it also makes for much more predictable revenue.
Go buy your mama a house. Go buy your whole family houses. Put this money in your savings account. Go spend some money for no reason. Come back and ask for more.
Instead of putting all of their eggs in one basket, these companies spread the risk out over dozens of studios and hundreds of different titles. Some of them will do well and some of them will fail. But as long as those winners pay for the losers and then some, the business is sound. Managing lots of smaller developers also means that these big companies get exposure to lots of different areas of the gaming market. There's money to be made in hardcore competitive games, story-driven games, social games, and mobile games, but it's impossible to make a game that makes money from all of these markets at once. Unfortunately, big-budget games are going to become less and less common. Video games are a business, and businesses need to go where the money tells them to. Candy Crush is one of the highest grossing games of all time, and it was made on an initial budget of less than $1 million.
Tasty.
For as long as customers are content with the games they currently have, and are willing to spend more money on the titles that came out decades ago, game companies are going to avoid taking risks that could sink their entire business.